from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Bernard-Henri Lévy has been described as the French playboy philosopher who toppled Gaddafi, and by the same British newspaper as France's favorite punching bag. He'll join us to discuss his new book, The Genius of Judaism, and he'll also talk about what he sees as the crisis of liberalism.
All that made the Brexit possible is probably one of the roots of this crisis of liberalism in the two daughter countries, which are America and Europe.
It's all coming up next. Join us for Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Welcome to this opening hour of the Forum program. French intellectual, author, and filmmaker Bernard-Henri Lévy joins us to discuss in this hour his new book, The Genius of Judaism, which is a personal reckoning with his religious and cultural roots. His previous books include American Vertigo, Barbarism with a Human Face, and Who Killed Daniel Pearl? And his films include A Day in the Death of Sarajevo, and we also have an opening of his film on the Peshmerga next week at Lincoln Center in New York, and we welcome him to the Forum program. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Michael.
I guess I'd like to begin by maybe having you talk about what it means to be called an intellectual, because you're often described as France's foremost intellectual, as one of Europe's foremost intellectuals. Public intellectual usually is the word that precedes that. And as an intellectual, you are also a man who is very much engaged, and that's a lot of what your book is about, engaged in politics and world affairs. Is that what it means to be an intellectual, to be engaged?
Yes, I am an intellectual for sure, a committed intellectual. But the model of that, the inventor of the public intellectual is a Jew. It is, in a way, Jonah. I devote big part of my Genius of Judaism to the story of Jonah. Jonah, who goes to the city, which is the city of evil, the city of sin, in order to speak to the people, the bad people. This is what a public intellectual does, in a way. So Jonah is the ancestor of the public intellectuals.
And you do see a great deal of your own intellectual heritage tied to Judaism, tied to the Jewish religion. It's very apparent in your new book. It's a morality, really, that we're talking about here, isn't it?
It is a morality. It is a relationship to text. It is a way of understanding history, the man, the law. It is all of that. And this book, The Genius of Judaism, is probably the most crucial of all my life. I'm working on it secretly since decades. I was writing American Vertigo, Who Killed Daniel Pearl, all the books you quoted. But during this time, my time was divided between day and night. At night, since 20 years, I was writing The Genius of Judaism, which is the epicenter, the core, the beating heart of all that I tried to write and do since my young age.
You had an interview recently in the New York Times in which you compared what's happened in the United States to what happens in Philip Roth's novel, The Plot Against America, which is the election of Charles Lindbergh. It's a proto-alternate history. And I mention that because Roth is someone who makes – I want to talk with you about the election and about Brexit. But Roth is someone who makes a distinction between Judaism and Jewishness, Jewishness being more an identity, Judaism a faith. You're talking about faith here?
I'm talking about the faith in texts. I'm talking about the faith in ethics. I'm talking about the faith in infinite commentary. When I say faith, for me, Judaism is not really a religion. Or at least you can be a very faithful Jew, though being a secular. Never forget that in the Mishneh Torah of Maimonides, the question of belief in God arrives very late. He begins the Mishneh Torah by speaking about the truth. by speaking about the knowledge. He says that what is required from a Jew is to know, to be intelligent, to go beyond clichés. And the question of the belief in God arrives very late. You can be a good Jew even if you doubt.
Many rabbinic authorities would, of course, disagree with that because they see the core of Judaism as monotheism and as belief in God and reverence of God.
A lot of rabbi authorities would agree with what I'm telling you. The Gaon of Vilnius, one of the biggest authorities of the 18th century, said that if he had to choose between a lazy Jew, not working but believing, and a good student doubting, he would prefer the latter. And his disciple, his inheritor, Rabbi Chaim of Volozhin, said that the real Jewish experience is not the presence of God, but the absence of God. It's the tzitzum, as the Kabbalist says, the tzitzum, which is the retreat of God. One of the most vertiginous Jewish experience is the retreat of God, the emptiness of the sky, and then what have the Jews to do? What have we as Jews and as women and men to do if it is true that God went away out of the world? This is a Jewish question. And this is why the secularity is embedded in the Jewish message.
Well, God did sort of take absence in many people's minds, particularly after the Holocaust. Richard Rubinstein wrote a book called After Auschwitz, which pretty much takes that position. We're talking, if you've just joined us, with Bernard-Henri Lévy, who is the author of a new book called The Genius of Judaism, which is really a book about Talmudic tradition. You mentioned the Mishnah, which is, of course, part of Talmud, but also the idea of argument and conflict and representing the dispossessed, representing those who need most to be helped. That's the core argument, isn't it?
For me, it is the core argument. Both of them are core argument. Number one, discussion, questioning, chaining paradoxes one after another. This is Judaism. And this is why, by the way, to be a real Jew means to be very opposite to dogmatism. I don't know. It's hard to know. A real Jew being a dogmatic or a fanatic. Because fanaticism means what? It means the belief in a frozen letter, a letter which is said and done once and forever. No Jew believes that. The Talmudic tradition believes that the letter is a vibrant body, a vivid body, a living body, and that it has to be put into motion on and on, which is exactly the opposite of dogmatism and fanaticism. After that, the otherness, yes, the unnamed, the cursed people, the most oppressed, I think that they are those to whom a Jew, as I understand him in the Genius of Judaism, has to address. And this is what I try to do, a big part of my life, not enough.
Well, you've been to Bosnia, you've been to Libya, you've been on the side of the Kurds, you have a movie film coming out about the Peshmerga. You have taken a stand on many occasions, and perhaps we can talk about some of those, or our listeners may want to bring them up, but certainly that has to do with being engaged and being a part of representing the dispossessed, the forgotten, the other, as you put it in your book. Although there are always dangers, too. I mean, I think, for example, of Libya, and Libya now may be in more of a crisis state, some would argue, that it was before Gaddafi fell, because there's so much chaos and so much influence of ISIS that has crept in. You played a very significant role in what happened in Libya. I mean, it's been certainly codified and in many ways represented under many occasions, but this is the argument one often hears. In other words, in fact, there's an old Jewish saying, this czar was bad enough, we don't need a new one.
Michael, number one, there was, if you call real chaos, misery, oppression, torture, mass killings, there was more chaos in the time of Gaddafi than after. Number two, if you compare Libya after intervention to Syria without intervention, clearly the result is much better in Libya. Syria is the shame of our generation, and it is the shame of us who could not ask and provoke an intervention. And number three, to be a Jew means also that. It is a story of the servant Hagar in the desert with the baby Ishmael. She is dying from thirst. And God decides to save her and to save the baby Ishmael. The angels around God say, but God, what are you doing? Ishmael is Ishmael. He is going to be the father of the worst enemy for Israel. They will defeat you and kill us. God says, we never know. And anyway, we have the moral duty here and now to save a suffering people, to prevent an injustice and sometimes a massacre, whatever could be the consequences. This is really one of the cores of the Jewish message. If not, you can be a geopolitician, you could calculate, you could make some geostrategy. This is not Judaism. As a Jew, I think that when the city of Benghazi was threatened to be invaded by rivers of blood by Gaddafi, there was a duty which was to prevent that. As we had the same duty in Syria, and we did not do it, and this will be the shame of our generations.
Well, since you mentioned Ishmael and Syria, I'm interested in finding out your thoughts about what you seem to feel is right at the core of what civilization is facing now in terms of the light and the dark from Islam, as opposed to the jihadist movement. We have you talking about Peshmerga. We have you talking about what happened in Bangladesh, for example, where women who were raped were brought out and embraced, essentially, or what happened in the attempt to intervene in Bosnia on the side of the Muslims there. In other words, you see both hope on the one hand and despair on the other. And that's the battle? It's a kind of like a Manichaean battle?
Not Manichaean, but the thesis, the principle of what I try to develop in the genius of Judaism is that if there is a clash of civilization, if there is a clash, the only one which I know is inside the civilization of Islam, the clash between fanatics and democrats, the clash between radicals and enlightened Muslims. This is the very drama, the biggest stake of our time. And if we have a duty, us as Americans, as French, and maybe as Jews, it is to support the Democrats. These Democrats in the Arabic world who fight the fanaticism and the jihadism at the expense of their life, who are the biggest numbers of victims, by the way, of the radicals, we have a duty of support by all means. They are our friends, they are our brothers, they are our allies, and we don't help them enough. This is what I say in the genius of Judaism.
You also talk about the fear, really, that is attached to not only jihadist Islam, but also the loss of democratic values and the rise of what we see in Brexit or what we see in Trump or what we see against liberalism throughout the world. In your own country, for example, with Le Pen, although Marie Le Pen has tried to dissociate herself to some extent from her father. I don't even believe they're on speaking terms now, as far as I've understood.
She did not dissociate. She pretends to dissociate. It is like in Austria. I just read a piece before entering this studio about some Jews in Austria falling into the trap of the fascist party, the FPO, trying to extend to them. They are still anti-Semite, whatever they say, whatever seduction they try to make, they are the same. The DNA of these populist parties has not changed. And for the West, for the Democrats of the world, and for the Jews, this is a very crucial moment, and we have to be very careful of not falling in the trap.
There are those who would say that anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism are two separate. You do not see the separation.
No, I say that the only way, listen exactly what I say, please, that the only way to be anti-Semite today is to be anti-Zionist. It is the only way. If you want to be really, if someone wants to be really anti-Semite, if he wants to gather a big crowd around his credo, his creed, he has to be anti-Zionist. Anti-Zionism is the best flag is the best disguise, is the best dressing for an efficient anti-Semitism. The question of anti-Semitism has always been to find the good wording to make his hate sort of legitimate. Today, anti-Zionism is the most efficient way to give legitimacy to the anti-Semitism. I demonstrate that in the book mathematically, not as a creed. I don't believe that. I show it in a geometric, algebraical way, if I dare say.
We're talking with Bernard Henri Lévy, who is the author of The Genius of Judaism. What about those who say, with the settlements in Israel, the ongoing, and I know that you're opposed to the ongoing settlement, but also under a kind of right-wing Likud party and Netanyahu, that Israel has sacrificed a lot of its moral authority. Sal Bellow once said Israel is kind of the moral Switzerland of the world, where everybody can relax and criticize Israel. But there are people who say Israel, is occupying Gaza. It has to be criticized. It has to be held to account. And there's the BDS movement, the boycott divestment movement, which says essentially these kinds of arguments. Do you place those in the anti-Semitic camp?
BDS movement, if you look exactly as I say, number one, they are pro one state solution, therefore they are against peace, first of all. Number two, they support some radical wings inside the Palestinian movement, therefore they are not Democrat, they belong in a way to the big totalitarian family. And number three, I say it to those of them who act and think BDS in a good way, with goodwill. They have to think that the first one in history who invented the idea of a boycott against Israel, the first time when this idea of a boycott was phrased and implemented was in 1948, the very day of the birth of Israel, and it came from European and Arab Nazis. It was a Nazi mot d'ordre. It was a Nazi slogan, the boycott against Israel. So I don't mean that the two are the same, but ideas...
You're not conflating them. You're not putting them together.
No, but ideas have an history. There is a genealogy. I am enough pupil of Michel Foucault, and I read enough about Althusser or Jacques Lacan to know that ideas have an history and they owe something to their history. And you cannot hear today. I was recently in San Francisco 1 year ago, and I was in front of students who made a big pride of harassing Israeli vessels, of preventing them from unloading their merchandise. They were like hunters, electronic hunters. There was something so rude, something so savage, and something who reminded me, I'm sorry, so bad souvenirs in their pride of being hunters of Jewish vessels, or Jewish boats. So there is something really dégueulasse, as we would say in French, something very dirty in the BDS movement. And it is part of this big anti-Zionist movement, which is the best dressing again of the new anti-Semitism. I'm sorry to say that because I know that some of these people, students in the Bay, probably don't know that. They probably believe that they are fighting for peace. They are probably believing that they are fighting for the rights of the Palestinians and of the victims.
Fighting for the rights of the dispossessed, which is pretty much your credo.
Okay.
Many of them believe.
Okay,
yeah?
So if to fight for the rights of the dispossessed, they should fight with equal strength against the death of 400,000 Syrians. They should be as mobilized against the genocide of the Darfuri. They should be as strong in front, a few years ago, of what was happening in Bosnia. I will accept to discuss with the BDS people where they will stop with a double standard, when they will have the same energy to denounce the massacres committed in Arab countries by an Arab tyrant than the energy they have against Israel.
If you've just joined us again, we're talking to Bernard-Henri Lévy, and we'll give you an opportunity to join this conversation. He's the author of a new book called The Genius of Judaism, a man who is often described as Europe's and France's most prominent intellectual. Who do you think is going to win the French election, by the way? Does Le Pen have a chance?
You know, if Trump won, everything is possible. If Donald, who have predicted that Donald Trump could win? Even himself, he did not believe in his victory. Even himself, 10 days before the victory, he was cutting the expense of his campaign because he is a little stingy, and he thought that he had no chance and that he spent too much money. So if Trump won, anyone can win. Everything is possible. Yes, alas for our world and civilization. We are really in a critical moment, Michael. We are really facing a crisis of civilization with no perspectives for a lot of those who are listening to us. And this is our job, yours and modestly mine, to try to make our path among this fog and smoke of the no perspective of our present.
I have to ask you, since you mentioned Foucault, you're not a disciple by any means of Foucault or Sartre or any of the other great French intellectuals. In fact, you have said on a number of occasions you're anti-Hegelian, you're against dogmatism. You've said this previously in this hour that we've had together. What about the argument, and I'm wondering what you say, that particularly a lot of French intellectual thought, specifically post-structural thought, is nihilistic at its core? And that is also one of the dangers that we face, aside from Islamic jihadism and aside from many other dangers that we've touched upon here, that it's a different kind of, if you will, dogmatism, the belief in nihilism.
Yes, but I am not a nihilist, and I think that the genius of Judaism consists in opposing nihilism. Nihilism is a belief in death.
I think your book is actually a counter-argument against nihilism. That's why I'm raising it. Yeah.
Nihilism is the belief in death. The genius of Judaism is belief in life, in peace, in democracy, in otherness, and in life. So for me, nihilism is the enemy. And In the form of the jihadism, it is probably the worst, of course. But I would not say, I hear sometimes in France and in America that the jihadists have a strong creed and that we, Americans and French, have not such a creed to oppose to them. That there is a sort of unbalance of creed. I don't think so. I think that there is a lot of creed in the people who are hearing to us and the people who live in France. And just an example, I went a few days ago, I was in Mosul. I was in Iraq, in Mosul on the battlefield. I met there some American soldiers who have a creed, who really believe that they are fighting against the evil and for civilization. I met journalists, war reporters, as I was trying to do, who have a creed, who risk their life for the good. And I met the Peshmerga, who in a way belong to the West, the Kurds. They have a creed, an equal creed to the evil creed of the jihadists. So the battle is not over.
The Peshmerga creed is based on their Islamic faith as well. We need to mention. And we are coming up on a break, so I want to give listeners an opportunity to join this discussion with Bernard-Henri Lévy. Our toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786. You can join us now at that number, 866-733-6786, or email forum at kqed.org or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending this hour with Bernard-Henri Lévy, and his newest book is called The Genius of Judaism. He's a philosopher and an author. And he's here with us in studio. And here's a listener who writes, I always laugh when the American media calls Israel the only democracy in the Middle East. At best, Israel is a theocracy, as only Jews are the only people who have full rights and privilege in the country. If you include the Palestinian people within the domain of Israel, then Israel can be classified as an apartheid state, just like South Africa was in the past.
This gentleman has to read The Genius of Judaism because he will discover, I'm sorry, he has to order it on Amazon, he will discover that it is exactly the opposite. Israel is a full democracy. The Arab citizens in Israel have full rights. They are much more represented in the Knesset than any minority is represented in France or even in America. And in this sense, Israel is not only a model of democracy in the Middle East, but much beyond the Middle East. This is not true. And I would say even that there is probably, this is what I, again, what I demonstrate in the book. It's not a creed again. There is, I don't think that there is one country in the Middle East when the Arabs, the Palestinians, are more free than they are inside Israel. This is a fact. And there is no Arab-Israeli who, for anything in the world, will exchange his Israeli citizenship against whatever other citizenship.
Should Israel allow intermarriage, though? I mean, there are those who argue that the illegality in Israel of intermarriage, of faith, is a kind of apartheid.
Come on. There is also people who says that it is impossible to convert. There is people who say that Judaism is a question of blood. And as the Talmud says, finding its own face, the visage, the face, in a text, by reading a text in a certain way. Nothing to do with race, ethnicity, blood, and so on. This is a cartoon of Israel, a caricature of Israel.
Let's go to our callers. Let's go first to a caller in Berkeley. David, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. Well, I'm a Holocaust survivor's son, and I wanted to ask you, Mr. Levy, if you think there's any comparison whatsoever, I mean this seriously, between now and the rise of Hitler, and in terms of worldwide populism, a kind of the anti-Semitism coming from the left and the right. And I'd welcome your comment on that. And then one attached question is if you have any opinion on what a single, relatively anonymous person can do to fight against what's happening in the United States and worldwide.
Let me thank you for the call, David. We'll go first to the first question with Bernard Henri Levy. And are we in a time similar? I mean, it's always easy to make these analogies, but to the time of the rise of Hitler and fascism.
I don't think so, because we, thanks God, if I dare say, we learned from the past. The Democrats learned from the past. The Jews learned from the past. If I see my country, for example, France, where the Jews were blind in the 30s in front of the Hitlerian wave. Today, they are nothing blind. They know they are strong. They are moderately proud, but proud, and they will not accept the worst. And same in America. So I think the situation is not comparable. What can a singular individual do in these dark times? It is true that America and France are facing a dark time. To have Mr. Trump elected as a president, frankly, it does not look like what a majority of Americans think about their own country, because don't forget that Hillary Clinton won the popular vote. So what to do? To remain very vigilant, to remain very in distrust, not to buy the false promises and not to fall in the traps which Mr. Donald will set for his co-citizens.
Including,
there is a duty of distrust today.
Well, a lot of the concern, though, has to do with white supremacist ideas that have been brought forward under Trump's rhetoric, and people like Steve Bannon, whom he appointed, of course, to a very high position, who is with Breitbart. That's what has people concerned.
It is much beyond Steve Bannon. Even the relationship with Putin. I am a great admirer of America, of the democracy in America. I wrote a whole book about that. It is the first time that I see a president of America being best friend with one of the biggest enemy of America and giving him a triple A. Donald Trump said that about Putin. He said, in terms of leadership, I give my enemy Putin a triple A.
Except he didn't say my enemy, did he?
He did not say my enemy. His enemy was Obama, and his friend is Putin. So in terms of mere and simple patriotism, this is a real concern. This is a real problem. And I said that in Farid Zakaria's show a few days ago. I was so surprised that when it became clear that the
Russian secret services did interfere in the election. It is clear today. The CIA, FBI said it, and Donald Trump admitted it. I'm so surprised by the quietness of the population here. I would have expected a bigger anger and maybe questions about the sincerity and the fairness of the result. At least questions. I don't know.
Well, when you're talking about speaking out and really making yourself heard and being engaged.
Not only speaking out.
But should you do it? Big question for you, I think, is should you concentrate on your own domestic concerns, as Americans might have to with Trump, let's say, or as French might have to with Le Pen, or find your Nineveh? I'll use that phrase because you write about Ninevehs that need to be found. That is, go to find a cause where something is being undermined and being destroyed and commit your heart to it and commit your resources to it.
I believe in the shining city above the hill. I believe that America is that. I believe that America has never been as great than when she, America, had a real concern for the rest of the world. And if America enters in an age where she will take care only of its domestic problem, then it would be a little America. Then America will be no longer great. America will not be back, but we will go back to a shrinking America.
And again, I remind you, you can join us at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Some tweets and some comments about the Palestinians. Emma says, your guest did not answer your question about what Israel is doing to the Palestinians. Not sure what she means there, but here's Kamran who says, regarding Palestine, your guest is a hypocrite, even as he calls others hypocritical. It's the greatest ongoing atrocity of the modern era.
Okay, I would like this hero, this auditor, to go again in Syria, to make a little visit to the people where ISIS was reigning till it was commanding till the last weeks. I would like him to learn a little, to go on Google about what happened in Darfur. He cannot say that the Palestinian issue is a real issue. I believe in the right of the Palestinian people. I believe in the two-state solution. I believe that it would be the honor of Israel to make this, to facilitate this. I believe that it is, by the way, the only possible condition of a long-term security for Israel. But you cannot say that the Palestinian issue is the most burning issue in the world. You cannot say that the only cause of the problems of this planet is due to that. Or if you do that, you think like there was a French writer in the 30s, precisely, called Louis Ferdinand Céline. And he wrote a whole book, an anti-Semitic book, called L'École des Cadavres, The School of the Corpses, and he said that the Jews were responsible for all the turmoils, all the tragedies, all the sources of war in the planet. This A is not true. This too has an anti-Semitic smell.
Let me bring more of our callers in, and let me go to a caller by the name of Sammy. You're on the air. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning. My name is Sammy, and I am Palestinian, live in Israel. And if your guest doesn't believe that we live as a second citizen, then everything he's saying is not true. Okay? How many houses got demolished last week? Ask him that. And how many houses are going to be demolished next week for the Israelis are up? And please, don't listen to him. He's a war criminal almost. He can be a war criminal. Okay. Leave us alone. Don't interfere with us. We can take care of ourselves. You come and you destroy our country. The whole regime is destroyed by the French. Did you forget what you did in Algeria? And did you forget what you did in Lebanon? What kind of system you put in Lebanon? What kind of system you putting in every single Arab country? Leave us alone. Don't give us your democracy. Keep your democracy to yourself and get out of our life. we can live, we can take care of ourselves without you being a nice human being when you are a war criminal.
Sammy, you raise a lot of points. I want to give Mr. Levy an opportunity to respond. But let's take these one at a time, though. He talks about colonialism. We can get to that. But he talks about destroying houses. There has been a good deal of indictment of Israel for destroying houses of those who were, you know, fomenting terrorism. In other words, the parents were almost responsible for the sins of the sons, let's say, because the whole house was destroyed. And when he talks about second-class citizenship, that's a reality, is it not, in Israel of Palestinians?
How can you say that? In Israel, the Arabic is one of the two official languages. Official language.
Let me ask you, would you say African-Americans are second-class citizens in the United States generally, even though they serve in high capacities and they are in Congress?
You must not mix two things. Class struggle is one thing, and you have in Israel, like in America, some poor people, some oppressed people who are unfortunately, and we have to fight against that on the bad side of the economic border. You have this in Israel, Arabs, of course, and also Sephardic Jews, who are often the poorest among the poorest, but in terms...
Who are also second-class citizens, often.
Not second-class citizens. No, they are poor, they are oppressed, but they have the full citizenship. They are represented in the parliament. They can look at what was happening two weeks ago with these soldiers who shot dead by the bullet in the head a Palestinian. He was condemned by the Israeli justice.
And Netanyahu and others want him pardoned.
But
the process went ahead, the judicial process
But he was condemned. Mr. Bibi Netanyahu can say whatever he wants. As in any great democracy, he is not above the justice. The justice said in a time of war that a soldier who lost his nerves and committed a murder had to be recognized guilty. This is the honor of Israel.
I'll bring more callers on, and let me go next to Brad. You're on the air. Good morning.
Hi, thank you. To have a fair and civil dialogue in Western nations and across the world, we have to have a standard. We can't have doublespeak. If I don't agree with the standards and the actions of Israel, and I decide to boycott, I cannot be called a Nazi, or I cannot be called like a Nazi. It's not fair. Similarly, to say that the Palestinian crisis is a crisis is not to say that it's worse than Syria. It's worse than Darfur. It's still bad. I have the right to disagree with it. And to silence me by calling me a Nazi or calling me an anti-Semite is unfair. This kind of dialogue cannot be fruitful. We need to have a single standard. We cannot call Hamas terrorists and anybody who disagrees with Israel and anti-Semite and have a civil dialogue. This has to end. We will not move forward until we have some civil discussion. And to have these double standards is unacceptable.
All right, Brad's saying you have the right to boycott whomever you please, and it doesn't make you a Nazi. It doesn't make you an anti-Semite.
He has the right to boycott whatever he wants, and I have the right to tell him that this boycott attitude toward Israel has its root in a very dark time. I have the duty to tell him also that I am favorable not only of a civilian dialogue, I'm in favor of a political dialogue. I'm in favor of peace between Israeli and Palestinians. I say in my book, I relate how all my life, since 40 years, and how and under which parameters I did fight for the peace. But if you are for the peace, you have to say also who opposes the peace? What is the biggest obstacle to the peace? Maybe the settlements are, surely they are an obstacle, but there is one much bigger opposition to the peace, which is the Palestinian refusal of the very essence of Israel, number one, of the very presence of Jews in some part of the area. And at the end of the day, Mr. Ehud Barak, in 2000, Mr. Ehud Olmert, 8 years after, proposed a peace. It was not perfect. It had to be discussed. It should have been discussed. But it had been rejected as such by the Palestinian authorities. And I don't speak about the Hamas, who belong to the big family of the Muslim Brotherhood and who don't give a damn about having a state. One of the problems of the Palestinian, if they have, that they have a leadership which uses them, the Palestinian, as a tool and who don't want sincerely a state. This is one of the points. And please, my friend, you will find this if you care. In this book, I relate, and demonstrate that very precisely.
The book, again, is called The Genius of Judaism. The author, Bernard-Henri Lévy, here with us in studio. Billy writes, it's so sad and upsetting to keep hearing anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism as mutually exclusive. People pointing out the atrocities committed by Israelis against Palestinians are anti-apartheid, anti-fascist, and anti-Nazism, not anti-Semitic. There it is again.
Are we going to speak about anti-Semitism all this show? It's a pity. This is the greatest show on NPR in America, and we are discussing anti-Semitism is a bore. It's a loss of time. I prefer to speak myself, and this is what I do in The Genius of Judaism, of what the Jewish thought brings to the world, of in which way it enriches the civilization. A lot of Jews in the generation of my fathers were claiming what the world did owe to them. My question in this book is what I can give to the world.
Well, John Kennedy said it for Americans best. Ask not what
I know,
your country
and
can
John
do
Kennedy
for you,
was your best your leader. Country.
And let me get another caller on here. Philip joins us. Philip, you're on.
Hi, great show. So, you know, Putin is basically announced that he's supporting or financing the campaign in France from Marie Le Pen, who's a fascist. And it seems, you know, to smack of the Trump support. I'd love to hear what you think about that.
I think that it is a real danger. He already began. Marine Le Pen is financed by Putin. A lot of French banks refused by a citizen attitude to make loans to Marine Le Pen because it is a party which is not exactly a democratic party. She found the solution, the alternative in Putin. So Putin has a plan. The plan of Putin is to destabilize Europe. The plan of Putin is to make a project of society which is exactly the opposite of what we believe in America and in Europe.
Does he also not want, in your judgment, to create another USSR to go back to what the Soviet Union was before?
It's more than that. This also I try to develop in The Genius of Judaism. It is more than that. It is a strategy of power, sure. He said once that the disappearance of Soviet Union was the worst geopolitical strategy of 20th century. But there is more than that. We have to take Putin seriously. Putin has a plan. He has an ideological plan. He has some ideologists around him. He does not believe in democracy. He believes in illiberate democracy, which is a sort of new concept of which Putin wants to be the flag. And this goes against the national interest of America, the national interest of Europe, and what...
So this is another form of nationalism that you're talking about here?
It is a little more than... It is nationalism plus the hate of the homosexuals, plus the hate of the minorities, plus a form of anti-Semitism, plus the Grozny, the Chechnya method when he pretends to fight Islamism. By the way, again, a question which I ask in The Genius of Jihadism. Are we so sure that Putin is an enemy of jihadism? Do you know what is the amount of the strikes which the planes of Putin did in Syria who were targeting ISIS? Less than 10%. In Syria, the enemy of Putin was not ISIS. ISIS was, in a way, those who Putin spared, and he concentrated his effort in saving the terrorist, the totalitarian regime of Bashar al-Assad. So, of course, as one of your listeners said, we can say that we don't care about the Arab world. We can say that humanity is divided into two, us, the West, who have the right to democracy, and them, the Arabs, who have just the right to tyranny. It is not my way of thinking. I believe in the unity of mankind. I believe in the universality of democratic principle. And till the last breath of my life, I will try to implement this strong belief that the rights are for everybody.
And we bring another caller on. Chris, that's you. You're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me. I feel like the Jewish people have suffered probably the worst atrocity of the 20th century and probably in modern history in terms of what happened to the Holocaust. And yet there seems to be no sense of self-awareness or moral imperative to not inflict, you know, pain on another group of people based on their ethnic background or heritage. And I don't think what's happening today in the West Bank and Gaza is as bad as the Holocaust, but it seems to me there should be some awareness on the side of even the right-leaning Jewish leadership to say we can't oppose these draconian, this sort of siege on the Palestinians and still claim the moral high ground. I think it's really embarrassing when your guest says, well, we're not as bad as Syria, we're not as bad as Darfur, therefore what's the problem? If you're criticizing us, you must be anti-Semitic. And that's what keeps the dialogue, I'm sort of echoing what an earlier caller said, but that's what keeps the dialogue from progressing, and that's what keeps us from getting to a true solution. People who, with this knee-jerk reaction of, well, if you're critical of the right-leaning, you know, Israeli government, you must be an anti-Semite.
No. So I will embarrass you again, maybe. I'm sorry for that. But I don't believe, first of all, that what is happening on the West Bank is comparable to a Holocaust. Holocaust is something unique in history. And in The Genius of Judaism, I explain very thoroughly and carefully and in details why it is unique. And you cannot compare what is happening on West Bank to the Holocaust. Number two.
Can you compare Darfur or Cambodia or Bosnia? I mean, these were genocides too.
I can compare, but it is not the same. There is two singularities in the Holocaust. There is two. Not the number of victims, not the rhythm of the crime, not the planification of the crime. Other genocides have been planified, like Rwanda, for example. There is two specificities of Holocaust. Number one, the entire world was a trap for the Jews. And number two, there was not one Jew, old, young, living or dead, who had not to be erased from the memory of humanity. The specificity of Holocaust, at the end of the day, when you go through all the rest of the phenomenon, it is that no place to hide and no rest of the massacre. This is what made the Holocaust very special. But this does not mean that we don't have to mobilize against the other genocide. Opposite. And what I would say to the caller is that each time in the last 40 years, each time that the world had to face a new genocide or a new crime, I'm sorry to say that those who mobilized themselves, those who first screamed sometimes in the desert, were those who had the Holocaust in their mind, in their heart, and in their fibers. The souvenir of the memory of the Holocaust, far from being a way of not taking care of the others, is an alert, is a radar, is a sort of etalon of the inhumanity which helps to take care and to mobilize.
You know, you said earlier that maybe we were spending too much time talking about anti-Semitism when you want to celebrate really the genius of Judaic tradition and so forth, which is really what your book is all about. But I'm wondering about your own country because now France is facing enormous kinds of adversity in terms of, terrorism, and particularly terrorism of Islamic fanatics, jihadist terrorism. But there's a long tradition that goes back to the Vichy government and to anti-Semitism from the French themselves, which was quite virulent.
Absolutely.
And I'm wondering if you see that still as very much a part of the fabric of France.
It is a twofold fabric. You have this old French fascist, deeply rooted anti-Semitism, which I described long time ago in another book, and you have this second form rooted in a part of the Islamic, a little part of the Islamic tradition, and it is the mix of the two. The two are like the devices of a possible atomic bomb, which could be, but which is not yet, a really exploding anti-Semitism in France. We are not yet at this point. The French society, as the American society, resists anti-Semitism, refuses anti-Semitism. We know in France and in America what it was, and we don't want it to happen again.
We've got seconds left here. Since you brought up atomic bombs, I have to ask you, you have taken a position on the Iran agreement that was made. It's necessary because there's really nothing else that's affording any movement away from the nuclear?
I was in favor of this agreement, yes. I thought that Barack Obama, with the help of his partners, and especially France, did probably the least worst thing. I would not say the best, because it's very difficult. But the Iran was at the edge of the possibility of really assembling the thing and maybe throwing it. So, number one, at least it delays. And number two, it is a bet on the living forces of Iran, a bet on the resources of the youth in Iran, who maybe will use this time in order to improve and to process toward democracy.
Bernard Henri Lévy, good to have you with us on Forum. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Michael.
His book, again, is The Genius of Judaism, and another hour of Forum is up ahead. We're going to talk about psychosomatic illnesses in the hour coming up. Stay tuned for that with a famed British neurologist who has written a book on the subject. For all of us here at KQED, we thank you for being a part of our opening hour. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegas Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.